From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a live concert with singer and pianist Charles Brown. He was a rhythm and blues star in the 40s and 50s, and now in the late 80s, his music is getting rediscovered. Also today, we explore the fringes of reason with Ted Schultz. He's the editor of the latest Whole Earth catalog, devoted to UFOs, reincarnation, and other unconventional views of the world. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the long-awaited Batman movie, and rock critic Ken Tucker checks out the Batman soundtrack by Prince. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Joining me at the piano for a live concert is Charles Brown. Brown likes to describe himself as a singer of blue ballads. He had 9 top 10 R&B singles between 1946 and 52, including Driftin' Blues. His popularity continued into the early 60s when his songs Merry Christmas Baby and Please Come Home for Christmas became hits. Charles Brown's work is now being rediscovered. He recorded an album in 1986 for a label that folded shortly after. That album has been reissued by Alligator Records under the title One More for the Road. This week, Brown is performing at the Blue Note in Manhattan. I had the pleasure of hearing him last month at a public radio conference in a concert produced for a new NPR program called Blue Stage. That concert will be broadcast as part of the Blue Stage series this fall on many NPR stations. But right now, it's my pleasure to introduce a live Fresh Air concert with Charles Brown. Charles Brown, a pleasure to have you here. Let me ask you to open with the song that became your first big hit back in 1946, Driftin' Blues, a song you wrote.
It moved Louis Jordan out of first place on the Cashbox magazine and Billboard. Well, I'm drifting and I'm drifting like a ship out on the sea. Drifting and I'm drifting like a ship out on the sea. Well, I ain't got nobody, world to care for me. If my baby would only take me back again. Baby, only take me back again. No, I'm not good for nothing, baby. Charles Brown don't have no friend. Give you all my money. What more can I do? I give you all my money. What more can I do? You just a good little girl. You just won't be true. Baby, baby, bye bye, bye bye. Bye bye, baby, baby, bye bye, bye bye. Bye bye. It's gonna be too late, baby.
I'll be too far away. Ooh, bye-bye, bye-bye.
Charles Brown, now that we've heard one of your first big hits, why don't you play something new for us?
What is it?
Play a new song for us?
Yes, I would do that, yeah. Terry. This is a tune that I had the pleasure of writing. It's called Everybody Looking for Somebody to Love, Even at My Age. So we hope you like it. I'm trying hard to find someone to love to ease my mind. Seems I have a world of trouble on my mind. This heavy load burdens me. I'm gonna lay it down so I can be free. I must find someone to love for me right now, today. Every time I read the daily news, the headline print gives me the blues. Why is there so much trouble in the time? There must be someone far away. Well, I enjoy my life till I'm old and gray. I must find someone to love for me right now, today. All my friends seem far away. No family love seems it's gone away. I read the papers each and every day. That hate prevails, seems it's here to stay. I must find someone to love to ease my mind. That's all I'm thinking of. I must find someone to love for me right now, today.
That's a great song. I like that a lot.
You like that?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, I want to mention to our listeners that in the 1940s, you spent a lot of time playing with Johnny Moore's
Three Blazers.
Mm-hmm. And Johnny Moore was the brother of Oscar Moore, who was the guitarist with the Nat Cole Trio.
Right. Uh-huh.
And listening to your early records, it sounds like you were really influenced by Nat Cole when you were starting out in the 40s to record.
Well, you know, we had a trio at the time. And I didn't ever go see Nat Cole.
Really?
And I didn't want to see him until I had established a style of my own.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's usually things wipe off on you when you hear someone else. How you sit at the piano, and I never did see him sit at the piano until I was established myself. Because actually, I didn't know what I was going to do. Because John Hopkins, who had worked with Nat Cole before, was a valet. He had told us that, Charles, this is where you should sit at the piano. So by me not seeing Nat Cole do it, but we were two trios challenging one another at the time. He was more into pop and we were into the Race record group, but we were still number one at that time. We didn't know we were going to be it, but we had the Pittsburgh Courier run a poll, and we won the poll, but Carlos Gastel said, for Nat Cole, the Blazers are not going to win the poll because I'm going to send $1,000 in there, and I'm going to beat them with the votes, so he did that.
Well, you've influenced a lot of singers, and one of the many people you've influenced was Mose Allison, who recorded one of the songs that you did,
Fool's
Paradise.
Yeah. Yes. Sam Cooke did too, and a lot of the other people. I don't know, Johnny Fuller wrote this number. he was imitating me in San Francisco, and Leo Mester and Eddie Mester would go out as talent scouts and to find tunes that would fit me. And they heard this number being number one in San Francisco because this company that had it wasn't able to send it across the country and distribution. So he said, Charles, since they're trying to imitate you doing Fool's Paradise, why don't you do it? Then I did Fool's Paradise, and it was a great hit for me.
Would you play it for us?
Yes, I will. I often think of the life I live. It's a wonder Charles Brown ain't dead. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night, living in a fool's paradise. My mother told me, father told me too, someday my child, fate's gonna catch up with you. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night, living in a fool's paradise. Though I've learned my lesson, like all fools I've met, I've learned things are in this world. I remember to my dying day, my mother told me, father said it right, said Charles Brown, you're running your life. Drinking and gambling, staying out all night, living in a fool's paradise.
In the 1950s, you used to travel on the rhythm and blues circuit a lot, and you had a show, and as a matter of fact, Ray Charles, when he was getting started, performed in your show, opening for you,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, Ray Charles was opening for Charles Brown, and it was during the early 50s, and people thought he was singing so much like me, said, well, is that Charles Brown? So when I came out, they said, oh, no, that's Charles Brown. But at that time, Ray, I had to take Ray Charles around. In fact, all the artists that were in Shaw Agency, they were depending on me to carry them through because the promoters wanted to buy Charles Brown. But in order for Shaw to sell the other acts, he said, well, in order to get Charles Brown, you have to take the Dominoes. I took them through. I took the Clovers through. I took Ray Charles through. I took Ruth Brown, who just won the Tony Awards, through the Weinberg Tour. And then I had to be a criticizer for Fats Domino when he came into the circuit. I had to go to, came here to Philadelphia, and I came here at, he was working at the Baby Grand, I think it was on Pine Street off abroad, and I had to sit there and listen to his show. So when I listened to Fats Domino's show, you know, people here in Philadelphia, they were very funny, they were great listeners, and if they enjoyed something, they would give you a wonderful round of applause. So when he, Fats finished one number, he would take his time and they would smoke a cigarette. They would do a lot of talking. And so when he came up, I said, Fats, look, you lose your audience when you do this. You got to have your next number ready. And if you watch Fats Domino right today, when he gets through with any of his numbers, he goes right to the next number. So we are very dear friends even today.
Well, before we get to the next number here, I think what we'll do is take a short break. Is it? Yeah, we'll take a short break. Then we'll come back and hear more live concert with Charles Brown, Blue ballads.
Thank you.
With Charles Brown. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We have a live concert today with Charles Brown, and you may remember many of his hits from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, his hits including Driftin' Blues and Merry Christmas Baby, Please Come Home for Christmas. He has a new album out, by the way, that was originally out in 1986, and it's just been reissued, and that's called One More for the Road. And this week he's playing at the Blue Note in New York. You know, one of the things I really like about your repertoire is that you do rhythm and blues and blue ballads, and you also do some jazz standards. And
yes.
I'm going to ask you to do one of them now for our listeners.
Yes, it's one, Cottage for Sale, which was a very beautiful number. It's a sad number, but some people like the sadness because it happened to a lot of people in divorces. Thank you. Little dream castle with everything gone. It's lonely and silent. The shades are all drawn. My heart is heavy as I gaze upon a cottage for sale. Lawn we were proud of, waving in hay. Our beautiful garden is withered away. Where we planted roses, the weeds seem to say, a cottage for sale. From every single window, I see your face. But when I reach that window, there's empty space. The keys in the mailbox, same as before, but no one is waiting for me anymore. The end of my story is told on the door. A cottage for sale.
Really making a comeback now, and I was wondering if there were periods in the late 60s and 70s, early 80s, that were difficult for you.
It was. You know, after I was banned by the Shaw Agency, they put claims against me in the union when I wanted to go see about my father. They had a lot of dates booked, and I didn't play those dates because I wanted to see about my father, so they sued me. So I was on a blacklist with the Musicians Union, and I had to go as almost a scab musician. And those were very difficult times. And a lot of promoters wouldn't pay you. They'd run out on you when they owed you money. You didn't know who they were at the ending. So I gave up. I said, look, I'm not gonna do anymore. I'm going to retire. I'm not going to play anymore until maybe something might come along. I said, I'm just sick of it. And I kept my piano going. I kept writing songs. I kept playing. I do my practicing every day, 1 hour, and to keep my fingers in shape. And I didn't give that up, but I had to take, I never forget, they say in our documentary that Ruth Brown we had called That Rhythm and Those Blues.
This was on public television.
Yeah, you got to do something to keep the funds going. People didn't pay your royalties. I did a little janitorial in the rich people's home in Hollywood. I washed windows They paid me good, $75 for a few little minutes. The windows weren't dirty, but I did that. And people would see me and say, oh, Charles, where are you playing tonight? I said, oh, don't worry about it. I said, you wouldn't come in anyway, so don't worry about it. I'll make it, because they would wonder how you get your money. So that's the way it is. So I had a few difficult times, but I went on until this point.
What started your comeback off?
Well, you know, Barry Feldman with Upside Records had sent out a notice in BMI to try to find me. And they sent a letter to me. They knew my address, because he didn't know my address. And they said, well, Charles, somebody wants you in New York, and it's Upside Records. And so I read this letter from Barry Feldman, and he said, Charles, the time is right for you. We would like to record you and put you back where you should be. And I considered it, and I made this first album. He produced it. He selected a lot of the tunes, and of course I had a few of my own in there. And we didn't expect it to be a big successful record, because we knew what the competition was here in the United States. It was just a matter of letting the people know that you were back, you know, that you maybe hadn't lost, maybe your voice got a little heavier for time, but you hadn't lost a little of your technique.
Now, this is the record that's been reissued on Alligator.
And Alligator, after all the critics gave us an A+, and the Larry Kelp out of the San Francisco critic gave us a full, almost a full star. He's a 3.5. You can't make a full star when you sell a million records. But when you get 3.5, it's tops.
I'd like for you to play another song. Can I make a request here?
Yes.
This is a song you wrote?
I wrote this number, Terry, but they never gave me credit for it. I wrote Black Knight. In fact, I wrote a lot of the tunes. I didn't know about royalties. All I knew about, oh, I wanted to play, and this would be, I thought a recording artist was just a wonderful thing to be. And I didn't know that the residuals that would come in later years about writing tunes. In fact, I would help other people, and they would put their names on it, not mine. So this is one of the tunes that you're about to ask for. What is it?
Who'd know we worked out these numbers in advance, right? Okay. This is Black Knight.
Black Knight. Nobody cares about me. Even got a friend. Baby's gonna left me. When will my troubles end? Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone. I keep crying for my baby. Now another day is gone. I've got no one to talk with, to tell my troubles to. Don't even know I'm living since I lost you. Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone. Another day is gone. Has the troubles, father has his too. Brothers in Korea, I don't know just what to do. Black night is falling.
Oh, I hate to be alone. I keep crying for my baby, but not another day is gone.
That's terrific.
Thank you.
Well, I don't feel like we could let you leave today without playing some of Merry Christmas Baby, which is one of the songs you're best known for.
Yeah, they know me for that. No care where I go, whatever time of year, Terry.
We have about 2.5 minutes left, so let's see how as much of that as we can get in.
Okay.
Okay.
Christmas, baby, you sure did treat me nice. Merry Christmas, baby, sure did treat me nice. Gave me a diamond ring for Christmas. Now I'm living in paradise. Well, I'm feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my stereo. Feeling mighty fine. Got good music on my radio. Well, I wanna kiss you, baby, while you're standing beneath the mistletoe. Just a little part of it. We won't talk about Satan coming down the chimney yet, Terry.
I'm so sorry we're out of time. The time just flew.
It would pass so fast.
It's really been a privilege to have you here. I thank you very much.
And Terry, I want to thank you for even having me on a great program like yours, because I'd heard so much about you. We listened to it. What Danny told me, he recorded a lot of things that you did. That's when I heard it.
Well, thanks so much for coming. It was just such a real treat to have you here. My guest has been Charles Brown, who's a rhythm and blues singer and pianist. And there's a recent album of his. It was originally pressed a couple of years ago. It's been reissued. And it's called One More for the Road. It's on Alligator Records. And I understand there's a reissue that's in the works of your early recording. So that should, I suppose, be out in the next year or so.
It's doing great, too.
And also, if you live in New York, you can see Charles Brown at the Blue Note this week.
Thank you
again. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Reynolds Price, and his new book is a memoir that he wrote after he learned to use hypnosis to explore childhood memories. It's called Clear Pictures. I hope you can join us. Charles Brown, would you play us out?
Yeah.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, alien abduction, trans-channeling, and spontaneous human combustion. Ted Schultz has collected Believe It or Not literature since he was a child. He's the editor of a new Whole Earth catalog called The Fringes of Reason. It's a compendium of odd beliefs with both the adherents and the detractors getting their say. Also, once again, the Caped Crusader takes to the streets of Gotham City to battle his arch-enemy, the Joker. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Batman. And our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Prince's Batman soundtrack album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Seven people were shot to death in Beijing today as executions of pro-democracy protesters continued in China. For the first time, Chinese officials are accusing Taiwan of involvement in the pro-democracy movement. NPR's Deborah Amos has details.
The evening news showed the seven condemned men before their execution. 27 have been shot in the past 2 days as Chinese officials say they will not bow to international pressure. The evening news showed the arrest of 13 men tonight accused of spying for Taiwan. Pictures taken with hidden cameras showed the men participating in the pro-democracy demonstrations. Some were accused of organizing strikes, burning cars, and killing students. The accusations are likely to strain relations with Taiwan, cordial in the past few years. The military in Taiwan have been on full alert since the massacres in Beijing and the nationwide crackdown. The official reason is the fear that China's hardliners may order an invasion of its island neighbor to draw attention away from China's crackdown. Other reports indicate Taiwanese officials are sealing their borders to prevent a flood of refugees fleeing arrest. In Beijing, this is Deborah Amos.
The Supreme Court today ruled that the government may confiscate the assets of a person charged with a crime, preventing the accused from using the money to pay for a defense, NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The issue in two cases was the forfeiture provisions of major federal crime-fighting laws. In one case, a Virginia man sentenced to prison for drug dealing was ordered to forfeit all proceeds from his drug operation. That left him without money to pay his legal fees. In a second case, the convicted head of a heroin ring was ordered to forfeit his house, his apartment, and $35,000 in cash. The forfeiture law used against both men froze their assets at the time of their indictments before they were convicted, and their lawyers argued left them too poor to pay for legal help, thus depriving them of their constitutional right to counsel. But the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, rejected that argument. Writing for the court majority, Justice Byron White said that if a criminal defendant has a constitutional right to spend ill-gotten money on his lawyer, why not on his constitutional right to travel? Ill-gotten money doesn't belong to a defendant, White said, so the defendant has no right to spend it, even on a lawyer. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
President Bush outlined his approach for encouraging volunteer service today in a speech in New York. The program, which he called the Points of Light Initiative, would offer $25 million a year in federal matching funds to encourage local charitable efforts. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
The president said he is trying to start a movement, not a program, and he made clear he thinks there is a limit to what the federal government can and should do.
We know that government can't rebuild a family or reclaim a sense of neighborhood. We know that during the past 2 decades, we've spent more money on more social programs than at any time in our history.
The key to constructive change, he said, is building relationships, not bureaucracies. It is not clear if the president was referring to the approach favored by some Democrats in Congress, a program of mandatory national service. Under Mr. Bush's approach, the funds would be used, among other things, to establish a network called ServNet, to encourage all organizations to donate the services of some of their personnel. And it would provide training and technical assistance to share successful local programs with other communities. I'm Jim Angle with the president in New York.
President Bush today also promised to enforce yesterday's Supreme Court decision that protecting the free speech rights of protesters who burn the American flag, but he called the flag burning dead wrong. He told a luncheon group in Manhattan that he felt obligated to give his personal response to yesterday's decision. Stock prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 17 points to close at 2481.79. Advances led decline 7-6 on volume of 177 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The new movie Batman has spun off an enormous amount of consumer goods, including not one but two soundtrack albums. One is the score of the film, Dark and Brooding, by Danny Elfman. The other contains songs by Prince. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Prince's Batman. Let's take a drive, love, so we can make up our minds, love, to commit the crimes of passion that sets us free.
It's not often that there's reason to be thankful to a media conglomerate, so let's acknowledge this unusual occurrence. How lucky we are that the new Batman movie was produced by Warner Brothers, which also happens to be Prince's record company. Otherwise, this meeting of pop culture giants might never have taken place. The idea of Prince writing a collection of songs based on the Batman story is simultaneously entrancing and laughable. After all, Prince may be the most gifted pop musician of his generation, but he also seemed nutty enough without aligning himself with a comic book superhero. As it turns out, Prince's Batman is written like a pop opera. The songs are assigned to characters, and you're supposed to think of them as you listen. Lemon Crush, for example, is a song that Batman's true but unrequited love, Vicki Vale, is supposed to be singing to her capricious caped crusader. If I'm working at my job, I'm the victim, you're the robber. I try to stop her, can't help, think about ya, let me crush, I'm ready. Most of the time, Prince doesn't really pull off this intriguing superhero opera idea, but at least this device makes it very clear which character Prince most identifies with, the Joker. In the comics and the movie, the Joker is supposed to be both evil and insane, qualities that Prince invariably links, in his naughty but moralistic way, with sex. In fact, what comes across most clearly on Prince's Batman album is something we've known for a while, that as often as he tries to contradict it with assertions of piousness, sex is the theme that drives his work more than anything else. The Batman legend in the best of the comic books is filled with furtiveness and dark emotions, and that's a pretty good background for Prince's latest elaborations on this theme. This collection teems with dirty jokes, leering puns, and the sort of cutting-edge rhythm and blues that makes the dirt seem deep. This stuff hits its high point with the one song that stands most clearly apart from everything else on the soundtrack. It's one of the most ferocious pieces of funk music Prince has ever written, called Party Man. Bad that the most superfluous piece of music on this album is also the one that most directly addresses the movie. It's the first single, called Bat Dance. What Prince has done is to take snippets from dialogue in the movie and make a collage out of them with a very minimal, abrasive synthesizer beat. It starts out aimless and vague, definitely not the sort of movie theme you'd imagine.
Oh, I got a live one here.
But then about midway through this noisy tedium, sex rears its head, thank goodness. Prince has to come up with some music that introduces Vicki Vale into the song, and it's as if the thought of actress Kim Basinger has inspired him to new heights of lewdness.
The song breaks out of the flaccid groove it's been mired in, and Prince develops a crisp, sexy riff that's as good as it is all too brief.
She is great, isn't she?
Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. I wanna bust that body. Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah. I wanna bust that body.
I'd like to.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah.
She's out there right now.
I wanna bust that body. Ooh, yeah. Ooh, yeah.
What's it like? I just like the sound of it. I've got to go to work.
It's hard to imagine that this Batman music will revive Prince's career, which in terms of the number of records he sold recently is at an all-time low. But creatively, Batman has made him loose and goosey. He's making music that's intentionally sloppy and way out there. Batman has inspired Prince to let it all hang out. As this verse of a song called The Future suggests, he's into ecstasy these days.
Yellow smiley off of me, ex. Like he's drinking 7-Up. I would rather drink 6 razor blades. Razor blades from a paper cup. He can't understand, I say too tough. It's just that I've seen the future. Boy, it's rough. Future and it will be. I've seen the future and it works. If there's life after, we will see. So you can't go like a jerk. No, no.
Prince from his new album Batman. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Believe it or not, literature, with its stories of flying saucer abduction, spontaneous human combustion, lost continents, trance-channeling, astral travel, has been the lifelong interest of Ted Schultz. He's the editor of The Fringes of Reason, the latest edition of the Whole Earth catalog. He's a former editor of the Whole Earth Review. Schultz describes his new book as a carnival of unorthodoxy with a twofold purpose, to entertain and debunk.
First and foremost, the idea of the book is to be a celebration of strange, unorthodox beliefs. Whether or not these ideas are true, I think one can enjoy them and celebrate them as examples of human creativity. Then I think, secondly, the book also attempts to evaluate whether or not these things are true, which is quite separate from whether we can enjoy them or not as ideas and concepts. So I try to do both. And the way that I try to do the second thing, evaluate whether they're true or not, is by giving a diversity of opinion. I tried to include the opinions of true believers as well as the opinions of skeptics.
You have an essay in The Fringes of Reason about alternate geographies, and these are, for instance, people who still believe that the Earth is flat.
Yes.
What I find interesting about that is the persistence in believing something in spite of all the contradictory evidence around you.
Yes. I find that to be one of the most appealing things about believers in strange beliefs. I guess that tells me that there's something about adopting a coherent worldview and doggedly sticking to it that that is essential for people in general, I think. And most of us consider ourselves slightly more reasonable, and therefore we would adopt a slightly more reasonable worldview, and we might adjust it in the face of contrary evidence, whereas these folks, evidence has very little to do with it. It's the worldview itself and what that does for them psychologically and sociologically, too, because it binds these people together into a tightly knit group of believers who often have their beliefs reinforced by the very derision and disagreement of everyone else around them.
You've collected strange but true literature for years. Do you have any favorite brochures or books in your collection?
Well, you mentioned alternate geographies, and some of the Hollow Earth literature is among my favorite. There's a book, for instance, called The Hollow Earth, The Greatest Geographical Discovery Ever Made, which I mailed away for when I was, I think, in eighth grade. I saw an ad in Fate magazine that said things like, what is the mysterious world that Admiral Byrd discovered beyond the poles? Why is pollen found sprinkled across icebergs every winter? Why do some birds fly north in the winter? Why do warm currents flow down from northern regions? I mailed away for this book, and it just expounded on this whole theory of how the Earth is not a solid sphere. It's a hollow shell, and there are vast openings at the poles, so vast that if you sail across the curvature of the opening, it's akin to sailing across the curvature of the Earth. You don't notice it. And soon you're inside this world that has vast seas and continents on the inner side of the shell. There's a central sun suspended at the center that lights this whole inner world. And there are civilizations in there that pilot flying saucers, and that's who we see flying around in unidentified flying objects. And dinosaurs live in there, and woolly mammoths are still alive in there. It was great.
Well, it explains everything. No, it's just really, it just explains everything.
Well, that's the way a lot of these sort of alternate belief systems are. They do. They explain everything. Origin of flying saucers, where you go when you die, who's running the show.
In 1973, you went to California to explore the New Age movement. What inspired you to do that? Were you a seeker yourself, or were you going as a skeptic?
I wasn't a skeptic. I was a seeker. I had spent 2 years in college. I was dissatisfied with what academia had to offer. And meanwhile, I discovered Eastern mysticism. A lot of the books I was reading at the time that really impressed me had San Francisco imprints on the publisher pages, so I decided the San Francisco Bay Area was the place to be. So I went out there with a totally open mind, and I spent a dozen years probably exploring all sorts of alternate belief systems, especially spiritual, mystical type systems, with the hopes of finding something larger than life.
And did you?
I think I did. It's not, I think, anything specific in any of these belief systems. I think what I discovered had more to do with psychology, I guess, lessons about personality and what it is, what it means to be at peace with yourself, to be genuinely motivated, to pursue your interests, whatever they might be, and things that are, I guess, sort of the more ineffable aspects of alternate states of consciousness. Meanwhile, I discovered that the specific belief structures that were being offered in New Age San Francisco were pretty much mutually contradictory. Each thing described a cosmology, a way that the universe functioned, that simply did not agree with one another. And I think a big lesson I learned there was that you simply can't believe all these systems.
You went from your explorations of the New Age movement in San Francisco to becoming a scientist studying insect evolution. To me, that seems like a really drastic change.
Yeah. I've naturally had a lot of time to think about that, and I've come to the conclusion that it's not such a drastic change. I went to San Francisco to explore the New Age, and I've explored strange belief systems all my life, mainly because I wanted to know how the world really functioned. The realization I came to that all these cosmological systems did not mesh, and that there had to be some objective standard for evaluating whether something was true or not led me to the scientific method. I realized that whereas the scientific method may not be able to say very much about inner states, subjective reality, imagination, and states of consciousness, it has a whole lot to say about external reality, objective reality. And I've always been fascinated with what is real. Nature, it seems to me, is undeniably real. And that has led me to this strangest of all pursuits yet.
Now, you say that nature is undeniably real, but yet you have a whole essay devoted to people who are out hunting for the Sasquatch.
Right.
So these monster hunters are of great interest to you.
Oh, yeah.
Even while you're busy studying real insects.
Yeah, especially because most of them are PhD biologists firmly established in academic institutions. So they're not, you know, you can't completely dismiss them as nuts. Basically, we're talking about biologists who are also romanticists, who like to believe that there are some large undiscovered animals that still exist.
Ted, do you have a lot of hate mail sitting on your desk written by people who feel offended that you've contradicted their worldview?
I have some. I've gotten a lot of letters from people that say, I loved your book. It really targeted a lot of things that were long in need of criticism, but you made a big mistake when you talked about my favorite belief of blank. You know, I have lots and lots of letters like that.
Well, Ted, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ted Schultz is the editor of The Fringes of Reason, the latest Whole Earth catalog published by Harmony Books. He's now a graduate student of entomology at Cornell University. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Noah Adams and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. In China, executions continue of those accused of crimes against the government. In the United States, President Bush outlines his Points of Light volunteerism program. We'll have letters from All Things Considered listeners from around the country. And we'll talk with Wang Yanni, a 14-year-old Chinese artist who started at age 2 in China painting with a brush. She had done 6,000 paintings by age 6, has exhibited around the world, and has an exhibition opening here in Washington at the Smithsonian Institution. Also, a strange story from London about British eccentrics, some of the folks who make funny noises with their mouths.
Thanks, Noah. That and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Batman, the movie that has been circling our lives for several months now, finally opens this weekend in theaters all across the country. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Be forewarned, this is not the Batman of Biff Bam Kapow fame. It isn't campy or spoofy or light. In fact, this may be the best film that Fritz Lang never made. A dark, brooding, German expressionist extravaganza that will entertain you and disturb you. In fact, some may find it too disturbing for a breezy summer outing. The movie's crime-ridden Gotham City, designed by Anton Furst, is a shadowy, skyscraping netherworld that gives off hints of Weimar Germany and 30s industrial design. It's creepy and exalted at the same time. And through this delicious murk swoop two sworn enemies. The one who looks evil, but is really good, is Batman, splendidly played by Michael Keaton. The one who looks like a clown, but is really a nightmare, is the Joker, played to the hilt, and then beyond, by Jack Nicholson.
Gotham City always brings a smile to my face. Moving freak. Terrorizes. Wait till they get a load of me.
Behind this movie's Teutonic tone is a Teutonic myth, the myth of the doppelganger. If we meet our double, we're told, we risk death. Batman and the Joker are doubles of a sort. They've both suffered a brush with death, and they no longer fear it the way the rest of us do. Now they see the world outside them as temporary, malleable, and they act upon it in ways that reflect the horror they carry around inside them. For Batman, that means saving the world from horror. For the Joker, it means rubbing the world's face in it. The Joker's hideous grin is the result of a toxic chemical accident, so he invents a line of chemicals that cause people to die smiling. He injects the stuff in the cosmetics they use. He sprays it in the air at every opportunity. He's the very model of a modern criminal, an arch polluter, the ultimate product tamperer. Nicholson is brilliant. It's his movie, and he knows it. Following the maniacal line he invented for The Shining and extended in The Witches of Eastwick, he tops himself at every turn, raging and howling and gibbering. In fact, the trouble with this movie is that it understands the Joker much better than it understands Batman. The evil we see is much more vivid and convincing than the good. Michael Keaton is wonderfully haunted and subtle as Batman, and Kim Basinger is positively lustrous as Vicki Vale, the girl of both men's dreams. But the director Tim Burton and his screenwriters give Batman's inner churnings short shrift. We don't know why he donned his bat wings in the first place, and the movie blows its most dramatic opportunity. When Batman is finally ready to reveal his identity to the woman he loves, Burton lets the revelation take place off screen. Burton, who directed Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice, is a kind of pop visionary, and he gives the movie enormous pictorial beauty. But whenever he needs to speed the action along, he falters, and so the movie sometimes plods a bit. But then, the action scenes are never any good in Wagner, either, and Batman is nothing if not Wagnerian. It's film noir treated as grand opera, and like grand opera, it soars.
Music from Danny Elfman's score for Batman. Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Spike Lee's first movie was the comedy She's Gotta Have It. He says after the Howard Beach incident, he knew his next movie had to be about racism. On the next Fresh Air, Spike Lee talks about his controversial new movie, Do the Right Thing. Also, jazz historian Lawrence Schoenberg profiles tenor saxophonist Herschel Evans. And Ken Tucker reviews the horror film Child's Play, which has just come out on home video. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. NPR, National Public Radio.